Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. Events that happen during pregnancy can have lifelong effects for both mother and child. Pregnancy can be a time of risk, but also a time of remarkable opportunity. With me in the studio today is Dr. Ira Chasnoff, professor of clinical pediatrics at the University of Illinois College of Medicine in Chicago. And today we'll be talking about treatment and prevention of alcohol and drug use during pregnancy. Dr. Chasnoff, welcome to Line One and welcome to Alaska.
Thanks. It's been quite an experience.
Very good. Well, your research is quite impressive. You've done studies of the long-term cognitive, behavioral, and educational effects of prenatal exposure to alcohol, cocaine, and other drugs, developed strategies for screening pregnant women for substance use. You've studied effects on birth outcome of prenatal treatment and counseling. The effects of outpatient and residential treatment programs for pregnant women who use drugs, as well as innovative treatment approaches for children affected by prenatal exposure to alcohol or illicit drugs. So that's quite an impressive resume. So as you've come to Alaska and looked at the situation here, what do we know about the rate of substance use during pregnancy among women in Alaska?
Yeah, we're in the very early stages of screening pregnant women with a very easy seven-question survey that is asked of all the women. And what we're finding is some significantly high rates of a variety of drugs. For instance, about 38% of the pregnant women are using alcohol during pregnancy, in early pregnancy. 18% are using marijuana. There are high rates of tobacco use, about 25%. And then the illicit drugs, such as we're seeing methamphetamine, the opiates, all of these are coming up in the surveys.
So you say significantly high. Is that higher than other parts of the country, or is this part of a national challenge that we see?
Well, it's certainly a national challenge, but we are seeing, for example, we have data from a large number of states, and Alaska has the highest rate of alcohol use that we've found so far.
So looking at those rates, they add up to a very high proportion overall, but I suspect these are not mutually exclusive categories. Do pregnant women tend to use just one substance at a time?
Well, certainly what we know, one of the things that differentiates women from men when it comes to substance use is that women tend to be polysubstance users. So the idea that you can start prevention programs for opiate use while ignoring alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, that doesn't make sense at all. So certainly when we analyze the data, we do account for polysubstance use. So if you count the women who are using, no matter how many substances they're using, you count each woman once, 51% of the pregnant women were using a substance that changes the structure and the function of the developing fetal brain. And that's what we have to look at. We have to bring that number down.
So that concern about the developing brain, of course, is crucially important. A proportion that's nearly half of women is certainly of concern. Tell us some more about what impact a pregnant woman's substance use will have on the pregnancy as well as the child's life following delivery.
Okay, that's a big question.
We will dig through that in more detail, but let's get us started.
Well, overall, if you look at substances overall, there is an increased rate of low birth weight. That is, babies born weighing less than 5 pounds, 8 ounces. There's an increased rate of prematurity, the baby being delivered before about 37 weeks gestation, 40 weeks being the norm. You also get increased rates of infant loss, and the infants themselves are at risk for infant death. either stillbirth or death immediately after delivery. And you have to put this in the context, by the way, the United States has the sixth highest rate of stillbirths in the world. And if you think of the level of development that we have here in the U.S., and we're still the sixth highest in the world, you have to be concerned as to why that's happening. And substance use during pregnancy plays a part in that high rate.
So you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. We welcome you to join in the conversation by calling us toll-free statewide at 888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at lineone, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. If you're listening to the taped rebroadcast on Wednesday evening, we can't take your questions on the air, but we'll continue the discussion and would welcome your questions or comments by email. So, Dr. Chasnoff, let's dig a little bit more into those long-term effects of exposure during pregnancy. We've talked about the risk to the pregnancy itself and to the young infant. What are the longer range impacts of exposure? Let's start with alcohol, for instance.
Okay. What you have to understand is any substance a woman takes will cross over the placenta and get to the fetal side. So there is direct contact with the infants, between the infants and the substance. Alcohol crosses very readily and has an impact directly on the fetal brain. Early in gestation, the alcohol can cause the baby to be born with missing parts of their brain. There's a central part of the brain called the corpus callosum. And the corpus callosum plays a big role in communicating information from one side of the brain to the other. It's what helps us make decisions. It's part of the key part of the brain that brings information together, what some people would call common sense. So how do you use information around you to really make good decisions? Through gestation, it doesn't matter where you are in gestation, the alcohol can cause blunting of growth. So different parts of the brain can end up being smaller than normal. And then use in the third trimester, the last 3 months of pregnancy, when oftentimes women feel like, oh, well, now I'm almost done with my pregnancy. It's safe to start drinking again. But that's the period of brain growth, the most rapid period of brain growth in all of human development, that third trimester through the first year of life. So exposing the fetal brain to alcohol during the last 3 months of pregnancy can cause the baby to be born with a brain that's too small. And in fact, this is the leading cause of preventable cognitive delays, mental retardation that we know of in the world, alcohol use during pregnancy. And so obviously, we have to get that message out that third trimester is no safer than any other part of pregnancy.
Okay. So you mentioned the corpus callosum. That's the part of at the base of the brain that basically connects the two hemispheres. So we talk about some people being left brain, right brain.
Right.
We really need both of those. So when we think about fetal alcohol effects, there's a lot of terminology that's used.
Yeah.
We've had discussions about fetal alcohol syndrome. I think there's a term even partial fetal alcohol syndrome, alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorders, alcohol-related birth defects. Help us sort of sort through all this terminology. Some of it, I imagine, is an umbrella term, and there's subcategories.
Yeah.
Help us think through these effects a bit.
Well, yeah, it's unfortunate that it is so confusing, and we get into these alphabet soup discussions sometimes and label children with different diagnoses. But what it comes down to is fetal alcohol syndrome is when a child was exposed to alcohol, is very small, often low birth weight, and as he grows, he continues to be short and underweight. They have changes in the facial structure, And alcohol's main effect on the facial development is there's underdevelopment of the middle of the face. So the eyes are small. There's a flat nasal bridge. The area from below the nose to the top of the lip is underdeveloped. And so, you know, if you just put your finger in that area, you can feel that groove that is present. That groove is absent in children with alcohol exposure. Thin upper lip, a small mouth, receding jaw. So you can think about it as just undergrowth of the whole midface. And then the final criterion of the four is neurodevelopmental difficulties. And what people most easily recognize is, in fact, the cognitive delays, the low IQ. Now, the reality is that the great majority of children with prenatal alcohol exposure do not meet criteria for fetal alcohol syndrome. They rather have a mix of findings. So if the child has the facial abnormalities and has the neurodevelopmental problems, but has normal growth, then that's what's called partial FAS. It's sometimes referred to as FAS with normal growth.
Okay.
The one that affects the great majority of children, and having been in Alaska here in the past, and having had a chance to see many of the children, this is the category of children that's really flooding our schools. And it's called alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder, or for short, ARND. Now, what does that mean? That's the child who looks perfectly normal, who has a normal facial features, can be quite cute, quite beautiful. They have normal growth, but it's the brain that's affected. And those are the children that we see. They have normal IQs, but they have significant problems with learning and behavior. And a lot of our work is looking at that population because they're the ones that are missed. And a couple of years ago, we produced a film of children in their late teens, early 20s, who had been adopted at birth but met criteria. They were from my patient pool. They had met criteria for either FAS or ARND. And one of the young ladies in the film is, for example, is 22 years old. She has an IQ of 125. She's in her second year of college. But in the film, she tells the story of when she was in school, her mother called and said, you know, she has to pick her up. What time should she pick her up? And the young lady looked at the clock on the wall and said, I don't know, I have to call you back, because she can't tell time with an analog clock, which is when you the hands on the clock. She had to hang up, look at her digital clock on her phone, and then she called her mother back. So an IQ of 125, she still has difficulties with day-to-day living skills, such as understanding money, telling time. And that's a classic ARND, which translates into significant problems in school.
Right. We often think of literacy as a measure of intelligence, and it sounds like in this case, certainly literacy was a very well-developed skill, but numeracy was the challenge. Is that something that you see commonly in children affected by fetal alcohol effects?
Yeah. One of the characteristics is the children, when they're working academically, the subject they have the greatest difficulty with is math, because math is very abstract, and abstract thinking is certainly a deficit in children with alcohol exposure. And when we work with teachers on how to teach children with prenatal alcohol exposure, we try to help them understand that children with affected by alcohol exposure have good short-term memory. So they can feed back information to you immediately, and so you think they've got it. But where they fall short is, characteristically, they have difficulty moving information from short-term into long-term memory. And so I get families come in that talk about their child has Swiss cheese memory. That is, they know something one moment, and the next moment they absolutely don't. And that's what's frustrating for parents and teachers. So there are special learning approaches that we have to use to help children that will help them move information from short-term into long-term memory. And if you think about it, those are two different parts of the brain responsible for short-term and long-term memory. So again, it's the damage of the alcohol exposure that to the fetal brain as it's developing that has that impact.
So when we think about college majors or potential careers for these kids, sounds like accounting would be a very poor choice. What are the career choices in which these kids seem to thrive?
Well, unfortunately, that's a tough question because a good number of the children will always need someone there to guide them in their daily living skills. And it's an arena we call adaptive functioning, the ability to take what you know and apply it to daily living skills. And that's what differentiates children with prenatal alcohol exposure, for the most part, from children with prenatal cocaine or opiates or even marijuana use. Alcohol is the only one that affects adaptive functioning. And the difficulties with adaptive functioning are what lead to the ongoing need for assistance as they grow into adulthood. Of course, there are varying degrees of severity, but living independently is not always something that's going to be achieved. Now, as far as employment and long-term sustainability, many of the children end up in entry-level service jobs, and they can do well if the job is very structured. I can give you another example. A young lady in the film named Brittany, she does have fetal alcohol syndrome. Her adoptive parents have done a terrific job with her, and so as long as she has structure, she can do fairly well. She was employed after high school at a retirement center, working in the kitchen. And the instructions given to her were, after people in the retirement home eat, you need to clear the tables and set them for the next round of people that will come in. Well, she almost got fired because what she would do is go in, clear the table, and then set the new dinnerware on top of the dirty tablecloths. Ah. She didn't understand she was supposed to also remove the tablecloths. So she was close to getting fired, and her parents had to step in and talk to the employer and explain to them, because the employer thought Brittany was just being a teenager and just not doing the job. But the reality was nobody said, take the tablecloth off the table before you set it, you know, put a new tablecloth on. And it's those little things. So when we work with families, part of what we do is help them understand what they're going to have to do in helping their child remain employed. So Brittany's been in the same job now for about 3 or 4 years, and her employer has learned that they just have to be very clear and very specific.
Dr. Chasanoff, we do allow shameless plugging. So what you mentioned the film a couple of times. What is the name of the film?
Yeah, the name of the film is Moment to Moment, and it's about four teens who are in their late teens, early 20s, who have grown up with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. I guess I should define that term. I skipped that one. FASDs, that is a name that was created by the federal government. In all their wisdom, they decided they needed an umbrella term that would cover all children affected by alcohol. And so the term is FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Now, unfortunately, it has caught on as a diagnostic term, and it's not. And we see a lot of children being labeled with FASD, and that doesn't really give you, that doesn't help you because it doesn't tell you anything about the child. So we try to stick to the specific diagnostic terms.
Okay. We're going to go into a break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler, talking with Dr. Ira Chasnoff, and the topic is alcohol and drug use during pregnancy. We'll be back in 1 minute.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. I'm talking with Dr. Ira Chasnoff of the University of Illinois at Chicago Medical School, and our topic is alcohol and drug use during pregnancy. So before the break, we were talking about some of the manifestations of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and we talked about one particular problem being challenges in numeracy, that is working with numbers. I used the example of a young woman who was very successful at school, scored highly on IQ scores, but she could not read an analog clock. She had to use a digital. We're starting to get into problems with judgment and understanding sometimes why you're given a job assignment. One particular area of concern that I hear about related to judgment is naivete. It seems like these kids could be particularly at risk for victimization as adolescents and adults. Certainly, they seem much more likely to actually respond to emails that we all get from the Nigerian princes. Are there data to support these anecdotes? And what do we understand about why judgment seems to be particularly prone to impairment?
Well, before the break, we were talking about adaptive functioning. And there are two other arenas that are affected by alcohol. One is self-regulation, the ability to regulate their behaviors, regulate emotion. And the third area is called neurocognitive. And that's where we get into the use of the brain to make decisions, to understand connections between cause and consequence. And that's all based on damage to the central portion of the brain, the limbic system. If you just very briefly, the way that we do make decisions, the way that we plan and complete tasks is through the front part of the brain that's called the prefrontal cortex. And in the prefrontal cortex, a small area in the front part of the brain, that's where dopamine resides. And dopamine is the regulatory center of the brain. So as you take on different tasks, that prefrontal cortex is firing off, helping guide you and make decisions. The difficulty is getting information out of the middle part of the brain to feed into the dopamine system to tell you what decisions need to be made. And so, yes, there's good science to show us which parts of the brain are affected. But what it comes down to is damage to the functioning of the prefrontal cortex. And because of that, you have difficulty making decisions. I'll give you another example. One of my patients was a young lady. She was born to a mother who had used alcohol during pregnancy, was adopted right at birth, and we began seeing her when she was about 2 weeks old. She came in for her 9-year-old follow-up with me. And the mother was having problems because this young lady at 9 years of age was running out into the street and had just recently run out in front of a truck. And so I asked, her name was Susie, didn't you see the truck coming? And she said, yeah, I saw the truck coming. I just didn't think it would get there the same time I would. Now, what is she telling us? She saw the truck. She's not being obstinate about it. She saw the truck, but the image of the truck didn't transmit to the front part of her brain to give her the judgment as to know when that truck was going to be there. And so she looks like she has oppositional defiant disorder, when in reality, she just can't make those judgments because she's not getting the information fed into the front part of her brain. And that's why you see so many difficulties with this. And she will look right at her mother and say, but you told me not to run into that street over there. You didn't tell me to run into this street. And again, there's the corpus callosum responsible for moving information from one side of the brain to the other. What you get is the children will know the rules cognitively, but then moving them to a higher level of functioning so they regulate their behavior so that dopamine can go to work, that's where they have the trouble. And this has tremendous implications for the criminal justice system.
As I recall my neuroanatomy, dopamine is the feel-good neurotransmitter, and the prefrontal cortex, I picture like the bridge of the Enterprise. That's where Captain Kirk says,
absolutely.
All right, let's be careful with the dopamine. Let's look both ways, and your mother's advice applies to every street that you cross.
That's right.
So we've talked a lot about mothers, and so I think we have a couple of questions, both a caller and an email, that are very appropriate that are getting into the issue of fathers. So let me start with the email question specifically about the father's contribution to the child's cognitive function, and specifically, does paternal alcohol or drug use affect birth outcomes?
Well, I'm glad to see a question like this come in because, men obviously have a role in reproduction. Now, the thing, any substance a man uses, whether it's nicotine, alcohol, cocaine, methamphetamine, marijuana, they all cross into the semen. And you can measure levels of the drug or the alcohol in the semen. Now, the semen, of course, is the fluid that carries the sperm in the ejaculate. So that means all of these substances have direct access to the sperm. And what you get is low sperm counts. Mainly, these substances kill off the sperm. And the sperm that survive have decreased motility, decreased swimming motion to get to the egg. However, let me caution you, this is not a form of birth control. And those children, in fact, are conceived. The only human study was done in Seattle, and a group of researchers looked at newborns born to mothers who were clean, pure, had great pregnancies, nothing wrong, but the fathers of the babies were alcoholics. And what they showed in that study, the only thing they looked at was birth weights. And they showed that there was a drop of about 200 grams, which is about 6.5 ounces, in average birth weight in those babies whose fathers were alcoholic. Now, that's a statistically significant decrease in birth weight. And so that's just a clue that something may be going on. Now, the only information we have about other drugs and men, there was an animal study down in San Antonio. And those researchers took male rats and put them under a hood and blew marijuana smoke into the hood and then collected the sperm of the rats. And what they showed was that with exposure to the marijuana smoke, the sperm had changed into what's called double-headed sperm. So that indicates that there's a change in the genetic makeup that sperm is carrying. That's called epigenetics. Now, they let those male rats that had been exposed to marijuana and now had double-headed sperm, they let them mate. And when the baby rats were born, they all looked normal. They had normal birth weights.
They didn't have two heads.
They didn't have two heads. Okay. But when the baby rats grew into teenage rats, they collected their sperm. And they also had double-headed sperm. So the change in the genetic material of the sperm was passed from the fathers who had inhaled marijuana to the offspring. Now, that's the only real scientific information we have, but it tells us that a man who is using substances could be producing epigenetic changes, that is, changes in the genetic makeup that he's passing to the next generation, and those changes will last throughout all generations.
Well, that's fascinating. So it sounds like we're still learning the effects of alcohol and drug use by men. And I think it's important to recognize that 30 years ago, the concept of fetal alcohol effects and some of the risks associated by use among pregnant women was still pretty cutting edge. And in fact, as you were addressing that, I was recalling that when I was in medical school 30 years ago, this was still a pretty new topic. And one of my classmates asked the professor of what happens if the man drinks? And everybody burst out laughing. And that was very inappropriate because clearly he actually had the right idea. He was thinking about alcohol as a teratogen or a substance that can cause birth defects. It wasn't just a matter of the woman being exposed. So I'd like to go to Caroline. Caroline, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you, sir. Before I get to the question about the male's contribution, and I say male because it's not just humans. Apparently, I didn't know about the rat study. Let me just touch on the epigenetics and the impact that that might have a couple of three generations down from the inheritance from the mother or the in utero. In the mid to late 80s, I worked for a company that was a sponsor of the Alcohol Drug Abuse Conference, which our School of Nursing here put on. In the last year that it was held, there was a gentleman from Washington, D.C. was the guest speaker, and he mentioned that. And it was brand new, and I don't know which school it was from, but it was that if the male was an alcoholic within a year of the conception of the child was 1 in 4 chances of becoming alcoholic. And so that sounds to me like they had traced, before they even had the epigenetics aspect of it, they had been able to trace the impact of that, of the male's contribution to the problem. But I guess the final question has to do with how many generations down do the problems encountered by the child, whether in utero or with the father's contribution, how many generations have they been able to trace that, and what's the impact?
Well, in this particular arena, they haven't. Now, these studies have not been done in humans. It's only animal studies. But I'll give you – folks don't understand the impact of epigenetics, so let me give you a very real example. One of the questions for years has been, why do African-American women have high rates of low birth weight babies? Babies born below 5 pounds, 8 ounces. And in the literature, in the science, it has always been attributed to poverty, lack of access to care. And then some researchers asked the question, wait a minute, we now have a middle class, well-educated population of African-American women who have good access to care, and they still have higher rates of low birth weight babies. Why is that? And to make a very long story short, they developed a brilliant study. And what that study showed is the high rates of low birth weight today, and understand low birth weight is very dangerous for a baby's long-term outcome. The high rates of low birth weight today in African-American women can be traced back to the epigenetic changes induced by slavery. The trauma of slavery in early pregnancy, back in the days of slavery, is still having an influence on producing low birth weight babies today. And a lot of the new research that's coming out, we now know that emotional trauma in the first 12 weeks after conception can produce epigenetic changes in the cells of the developing embryo and fetus. And that's going to be there when you change genetic markers. Those genetic markers are there forever in ongoing generations. So there's not a question of of how long does the effect last, it does have implications for generations to come. And that's, especially the marijuana study with the rats, that's one of the questions I keep asking as we liberalize our marijuana laws. Are we asking the right questions now about what is it? What is the science about marijuana smoking that we can at least educate ourselves with before we decide to smoke marijuana or not? It's just a question we have to ask.
So regarding the epigenetics, I have to say that was a little disturbing. It sounds fairly pessimistic, although I think I would raise the point that among African-American people, not only is there the trauma of slavery, there's the trauma of Jim Crow, there's the ongoing poor socioeconomic status too often that suggests that the trauma continues. And I think, you know, we oftentimes use the term historical trauma, and maybe that's a term that we have to be careful with because it implies that trauma is something in the past and that we are avoiding the uncomfortable situation of confronting injustices that continue today.
Yeah, we see that today still. As I said, with the current studies looking at not only social trauma, but emotional trauma, personal trauma.
Right.
If there's violence in the home, you do get epigenetic changes.
Okay. Caroline, thank you for joining us on Line 1. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 888-353-5752, toll-free statewide. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. So we're talking up with Dr. Ira Chasnoff about the issues related to alcohol and drug use during pregnancy. We've spent the past 20 minutes, I believe, talking primarily about alcohol. You've made reference to marijuana a number of times. Again, welcome to Alaska, where retail marijuana is legal. Tell us about marijuana use during pregnancy.
Well, you know, there's a perception that marijuana is a harmless drug, and it goes back to the 60s when people say, you know, there was marijuana and everybody was fine. What you have to understand is that this is not your father's marijuana. The marijuana in the 60s, the concentration of THC was about 2 to 2.5%. By 2008, the marijuana concentrations of THC were up to about 9%. And the marijuana available today, especially where marijuana has been legalized, you can find marijuana, you know, this is capitalism at work, making a better product means, you know, selling more. You can find marijuana in some states that's 34 to 40% pure THC. So it's a much more powerful. Now, one experience that we've documented in a publication has been Colorado. We asked the question.
Which went legal in 2012,
so
2 years before Alaska.
Yeah. So the law in Colorado was passed in 2012. It wasn't implemented until January 2014. Okay. So a group of researchers at U.S. Drug Laboratories, which is one of the big centers in the country that does meconium studies, looks for drugs in babies' meconium.
And meconium is the first bowel movement, basically.
Yes. Yeah, the first stool a baby passes. And meconium forms through the third trimester of pregnancy. So you can study meconium to find out what drugs the mother used during the third trimester, the last 3 months. So they collect and run meconium studies for states all across the country, including Alaska. But what they did is they said, okay, and they never throw meconium away. You go to their labs, they've got meconium everywhere. So, you know.
That's just a phrase, I think, right? Meconium everywhere.
Well, in tubes. Okay. They're all in test tubes.
There we go.
But
just
it
making
is,
sure.
It is everywhere. But So what they were able to do, they said, okay, let's look at the marijuana in the meconiums of women in Colorado in the first 9 months of 2012.
This is specifically looking for 9-delta tetrahydrocannabinol.
Right, looking for THC.
Ingredient. Okay.
Yeah. So they said, let's look for THC in the meconium of women in Colorado, 2012, and compare it to the THC in meconium of women from all the other states. And what they found was about 10% of the women in Colorado, as well as 10% of the women in all the other states, had meconium, THC in their meconium in 2012. They then looked at the 2014 samples and found that all the other states, 10% still was the rate of THC in meconium, whereas in Colorado, it was 12%. So it had gone up 2% once legalized marijuana law was implemented, but that's not a statistically significant increase, which means that could have happened by chance, so we can't hang our hat on that very much. But then they also looked at the concentration of THC in the meconium, and the concentration was similar in 2012 for Colorado and all the other states. Then in 2014, the concentration of THC in all the other states stayed the same, but almost doubled in Colorado. So what you take from that study is that at least for the first 9 months after legalized marijuana the law was actually implemented, you didn't see increased numbers of women smoking marijuana during pregnancy. However, the women who were smoking were smoking more often and in higher doses. And so higher levels of THC were being passed to the fetus. And that's something that has to be considered. Now, our work in California before and since medical marijuana was passed and then legalized marijuana, we've seen prior to the passage of medical marijuana laws in California, in our studies, about 6 to 7% of women were using marijuana. Once medical marijuana came along, that number jumped to about 10 to 12%. And then once marijuana was legalized, it's now currently we're finding rates of 17 to 18%, similar to what we found in Alaska.
So it sounds like there's at least three different phenomena occurring that you've described here. One brings to mind an old Cheech and Chong joke involving oregano. What we buy at the retail store is a little more assured than what might have been sold in the parking lot. Second is horticultural techniques have evolved, and there's been more selection for strains that have higher THC content. The third may be that with retail availability, that easier access to marijuana use may be more frequent than in the past. So we need to go to a break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
Funding for Line One, Your Health Connection was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your co-host today, Dr. Jay Butler, and my guest is Dr. Ira Chasnoff. Our topic today is alcohol and drug use during pregnancy. If you have questions or comments, we'd love to have you join the conversation. Our number statewide is 888-353-5752. That's 888-353-5752. And you can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. And we have Carol calling. Carol, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I have an unusual situation. In 1982, I gave birth to twins. Now, the husband was an alcoholic, drank a six-pack of beer every night, and occasionally he would drink harder liquor. Not abusive or anything, good dad. And
I've lost it.
Marijuana, and he did too occasionally. Now, we gave birth to the twins. They were supposed to arrive in late December. They came February 6th, and they weighed 7.5 pounds plus. And there's no history of twins in either side of the family, all the way back to Adam and Eve. And these guys were mere twins. Half of one was identical to half of the other. So one of them became an alcoholic, and it almost killed him. And he's been sober for a year and a half, and I'm very grateful for that. And the other one had no tendency to alcohol, but is starting to move in that direction. And I'm wondering how much of that was instituted during the pregnancy with their father, because I didn't drink at all. I hadn't drunk in my life at that point, ever.
Well, Carol, the picture you're describing can really be attributed much more to genetics, the inherited aspects of alcoholism, rather than anything in particular that could be attributed to the pregnancy or conception. And we know that someone born to an alcoholic mother or father, the genetics of alcoholism can be passed down to the next generation. So I really think that's probably what you're dealing with. And yes, both your boys would be very high risk for alcoholism.
Okay, bless your heart. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, Carol. So, Dr. Chasnoff, we have talked about the effects of alcohol on the fetus. We've also talked about use of marijuana during pregnancy. Does it matter? Does marijuana affect the developing fetus?
Yes. Now, what we see, and there is a large epidemiologic study that has looked at this, one of the things that's been found is if a woman uses marijuana during pregnancy, there's a more than 2 times increased rate of stillbirth. The other issue is that if a woman uses marijuana in the first month, and it's isolated to the first month, there is an increased rate of babies being born with anencephaly. That's when a baby is born missing the whole front part of his brain. Now, we know that the neural tube, that is the tube that forms the basis of the whole central nervous system, the brain, the spinal cord, that tube forms at 16 to 22 days after gestation. And it appears that marijuana use during that time of neural tube formation can cause a failure of the front part of the brain to develop. Now, as a clinician, this is very concerning for me because I get women who call and say, well, I'm using marijuana, and as soon as I find out I'm pregnant, I'll stop using. But by the time you find out you're pregnant, there may have been significant harm done. There is a lot we don't know about marijuana, but it does appear it puts that early pregnancy at very high risk. And then the other thing, the long-term outcome of children exposed to marijuana, when you control for all the other factors we have to control for when we do research, children exposed to marijuana, when they reach the teen years, are more likely to smoke marijuana and have greater difficulties with executive functioning. And executive functioning, as we talked about earlier, is the ability to plan and complete a task, to follow through, to understand cause and consequence. So that clearly appears to be a long-term effect. And then there's one study of functional MRIs. That's when they do an MRI and they study the way the brain functions when given various tasks. And this study was done with 22-year-old young adults who had been exposed to marijuana prenatally, but had good lives growing up. Everything had been fine. They controlled for all the factors. And what they showed on functional MRI was that there were changes in brain function that they could relate back to the prenatal marijuana exposure, mostly affecting short-term memory. So it's very clear there is an effect of marijuana on pregnancy outcome and on the child long-term, but we need a lot more research to guide us.
So when we think about prenatal exposure maybe being a factor that is associated with use by the child later in life, I mean, it seems like it could be related to the effects you described earlier as it relates to dopamine as well as then the guidance by the prefrontal cortex. But it could also just be social situation, that a child raised in a home by someone that uses marijuana may be more likely to use marijuana themselves. Have we been able to dissect that apart?
Well, the only way you can definitively answer that question is to do a randomized controlled study. And that's not going to happen. So what the researchers in the studies that I told you about did was they controlled for, they entered factors such as not only parental use of marijuana, but how many of the children's peers used marijuana. So some of the social factors and socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity, demographics, everything you can think of, and it still came out that the marijuana was what put them at risk for the kinds of things we talked about. Now, that's the best we can do for research because in humans, we're not going to do these randomized studies. However, animal studies in which we can line up animals and randomize them and give half of them marijuana and the other half not, and then look at their children long term, the animal studies are showing the same thing.
Okay. So your message is no amount of alcohol or marijuana use during pregnancy is really known or documented to be safe. So a question that came in by email is, if you're a user of marijuana or alcohol, whether you're a man or a woman, and you're thinking about starting a family, how long should you abstain from those substances before getting pregnant?
Well, there's no real good answer to that. If you go to your obstetrician or your family practitioner and you've been on birth control pills and you say, I want to get pregnant now, usually, physicians will say, well, wait 3 months. Get off your birth control pills and wait 3 months before you start trying to conceive. There's no science to that. It's because no one really knows what the answer is. So I've borrowed from my obstetrician friends, and I say 3 months. Again, let me caution you, there is no science to that. We just don't know. Women are born with all of their eggs. Men make new sperm every 140 days. So that's kind of where the wait 3 months came from. And so in general, I would say wait 3 months before you conceive. If you've been clean for 3 months, the previous alcohol marijuana use most likely is not going to affect anything.
Okay. So one of the big differences between marijuana and alcohol is that there are some data that there are situations where marijuana is useful therapeutically. So I think we have a caller who has a question along those lines. David, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Thank you. And I've got actually a question and a couple of comments. I've been an acupuncturist for 45 years, so in the same field as you folks, and work a lot with pain management, and I have a lot of clients who have that issue who would rather not use opiates, who use marijuana for pain management. My thing is, how much of the studies are being done on not only what they're taking, but what's their dietary recommendation? I mean, how they, with diets, my concern about a lot of the statistics is they're doing statistics with people who are eating white, 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 and white.
Well,
so how much of it is, are you factoring in diet? Are you factoring meditation? I mean, and then also dose related?
Yeah, I thought you were going to ask another question, actually, the way you started out. So I'm going to answer that question, too. I thought the question you were asking was, what about using orally consumed THC as for pain management. And there are absolutely no studies. So I can't answer the question I thought you were going to ask. But I think it's an important question.
And, of course, one of the challenges being that marijuana is still, by federal law, Schedule I, illegal. It's very difficult to do those studies.
Right. Yeah. And that's part of what the problem is. But the thing that should be noted is that much less THC is absorbed via the GI tract. So when you take it down orally, than when you smoke it. But again, we don't know. Now, most of the studies that have been done have had, whether it's studying alcohol or cocaine or marijuana, they do control for dietary intake and socioeconomic status and the other kinds of factors you were talking about. And again, the studies have pretty clearly demonstrated the effects we've talked about when controlling for diet and everything else. Again, we can't line pregnant women up, you know, and say, you drink a pint and you don't. You can't do those studies. And so we do have to rely on the statistical control and match groups as well as possible.
So you also haven't mentioned, I mean, I'm said there's this horrible epidemic happening in New Zealand, which I say is a combination of violent American television and methamphetamine, where we're having 17, 18-year-old girls and boys bashing old women to death, stealing police cars, this grand theft auto stuff, all related to methamphetamine, which I think is like, you know, the most unbelievably destructive drug in around. What's your studies on that?
On methamphetamine use during pregnancy, I take it you're...
Yeah,
is
well,
that what you mean?
I mean, during pregnancy, even minor use on either the man's or the woman's side.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Butler mentioned earlier, we were talking about the dopamine receptor system, and dopamine is the pleasure center of the brain. So when you eat food, you increase dopamine levels 125%. When you have sex, you raise dopamine levels 150%. Nicotine raises dopamine levels 200%, cocaine 300%. Methamphetamine raises dopamine levels 1,000%. And so what you get is this explosion of dopamine, this sudden high, and that's where we see a lot of the kinds of behaviors you're talking about.
Yeah.
Now, during pregnancy, it's pretty clear methamphetamine has many of the same effects as cocaine, in that we see higher rates of babies being born with strokes and heart attacks in utero, and it has long-term effects on the ability to regulate behavior. And so the most common diagnosis we see in the children is ADD, ADHD.
Well, David, thank you for calling. We're running out of time. I know we have some other callers, so I would ask you to send us your questions by email, and we can follow up. So this has been Line 1, Your Health Connection. Thank you, Dr. Ira Chasnoff, for joining us today. You may have noticed that through this summer, there's been a number of headlines about infectious disease outbreaks. So how do we learn about these outbreaks, and how are new infectious diseases investigated? Join me next Wednesday when I'll be talking with Dr. Tom Hennessy of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for a discussion of investigating infectious disease outbreaks. Dave Waldron produced today's show, and the multi-talented Eric Bork is our web editor and was sound engineer today. This is Dr. Jay Butler wishing you a healthy life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.